who focused on gravitational physics in the next 3 weeks. This is basically a follow-on from Rob Meyer's course, core course on general relativity. So my aim, although I've been warned very, very harshly not to do too much, not to go too fast, etc., etc., which I probably will anyway, but you'll just have to try and sort of keep me under control. My aim is to try and cover sort of some topics in some more advanced general relativity. So I want to talk, I'm sort of aiming to tell you some physics of black holes and also talking about extra dimensions. So in a sense, I see this course as being a bridge between some of the further topics that you're going to be doing in the future. And I guess the primary ones that I see this feeding into are the numerical relativity and the string theory. But of course, obviously, there'll be implications with cosmology as well, although I'm not going to directly address cosmology formally in the lectures. But before, although the course is gravitational physics, I'm going to have to start off by doing some more formal maths, in the sense that I understand that the way you got introduced to general relativity was quite a sort of physical approach. So it was based on the physics of gravity. But if you think about the way you apply gravity in string theory, or if you want to sort of sit down and think about issues for computing with general relativity, a lot of the issues that you have to think about have mathematical roots. So you need to kind of have a good toolkit of general relativity available. So although it's gravitational physics, I'm going to start off with some mathematics and try, and basically a lot of this ought to be quite familiar from Rob's course, but it'll just be, you know, a sort of review going over things. Perhaps the perspective will be a little bit different because, you know, general relativity is essentially applied differential geometry. And so a lot of the times when you want to do something or answer a physical question, you're in gravity, you're resorting to some mathematical techniques in differential geometry. So, for example, if you want to think about brains of either in the context of string theory, D brains or general extended objects, or in the context of cosmology, brain worlds or brain inflation, then what you're often doing there is something, is a formalism in differential geometry known as Gauss-Kodaczy, where you're thinking of submanifolds. So that's an example where a little bit of knowledge of the mathematical formalism really helps a lot. So that's the plan. I've got two lectures this morning, and I'm going to just start off with this, a bit of a review. So I hope this is mostly familiar, but I'm going to, you know, for the first sort of couple of lectures, I guess, I'm not sure precisely what you've done or what you know. So you're going to have to sort of give me some direction there. And I trust you not to lead me down the garden path or whatever. So to just set the scene, I better say what my conventions are, because they're probably different from what Rob did. And I apologize for that, but if you don't stick with conventions, you know, you sometimes make mistakes. So what you did with Rob was probably primarily geared at actually perhaps just deriving the Einstein equations, as well as looking at the implications. So I said general relativity was applied differential geometry, and it is, I mean that in the sense that gravity is simply just looking at a curved space-time. And so all the phenomena of gravity can just be encoded in looking at the geometry of some particular manifold. And the manifold itself has a distance function or metric, which is indefinite. So it's not, when pure mathematicians developed differential geometry, they had in mind what we call a Euclidean metric, where everything's plus, 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 plus. So the sort of space distance that you're used to for normal three-dimensional space. But of course, as you know, GR has an indefinite metric. I take the signature to be plus, minus, 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 etc., if there's more dimensions. Typically, as you'll notice just from the way it's written, I'm going to set h bar and c to 1. So the only dimensionful constant that I'll ever have floating around generally will be the Newton's constant, g. And just to be clear, if I want to form the Ricci tensor, I use a contraction on the first and third indices of the Riemann tensor. And the Riemann tensor starts off in terms of the Christoffel symbols, just because I know some people sometimes use a slightly different convention. And so that is essentially differential geometry, where you relate the curvature to the energy momentum content, and that's Einstein gravity. So that was what you did with Rob, okay? And so what I want to do is just go over a little bit of some of the machinery that you had to build up to get to that point about manifolds, vectors, derivatives, Lie derivatives, forms, and so on. So a manifold, can you just tell me to what extent did he give you formal mathematical definitions? Not at all.
No manifold stuff.
Okay. I mean, I won't be that sort of rigorous either, but at least I'll mention it. So, as in, I'm not going to be a, you know, complete mathematician here. So what you should think of as a manifold, it's really, if you carry this idea of space-time around with you, a manifold is something which looks locally like a flat space. So it looks locally like some copy of R to the n. So this would be for a general dimensional manifold. And mathematically, you state that by saying that you've got some space which is covered by a sort of selection of what we call charts, which these take you into some, if we were just in three-dimensional space, would just take you locally into some open patch of R cubed. And you would have some coordinates. This is our idea of having coordinates. And then on these overlaps, you would have a coordinate transformation, which would be, in because we want to do physics, we want to be able to differentiate. This is mathematically known as C infinity. So what this is doing is it's taking this idea of having local inertial frames, the fact that we are observers and we have our own concept of an inertial frame. You can think of these little patches being something like local inertial frames. Alternatively, you can think of this, a good analogy is like the Times Atlas of the world. And so in each case, each page is one of these charts. It's taking you from the surface of the Earth onto some two-dimensional flat piece of paper. And as you go from one page to the next, you can match together these two sheets on a little bit of an overlap. So that's this analogy. That's what a manifold is. And you then define vectors, tensors, covectors by simply thinking about maps on this manifold. So we say we've got, we start off by thinking about functions on our manifold. Where we simply associate with every point on the manifold a number. That's just our function. And yes?
Right, so is the manifold the actual maps, or is it the...
No, it's the whole structure. I mean, so you think of the manifold, you've got your overall sort of set of points, this is your space-time, yeah? Then you have, on this set of points, you have these patches, if I call them sort of OI, so each is a sort of subset of the manifold. We then say that this manifold is like a union of all these subpatches. And then you have to actually have that each, that on the sort of OI intersect OJ, you have to have that, so what you've got is two patches, each of them has a map, if you call it X and Y, for example, into your flat bit, flat space. And then you've got, on this overlap, you've got, you know how to do things in flat Cartesian space. So you use the fact that you've got one, on this chart you've got one map to flat space, on that one you've got a different one, on the intersection you've got two little portions here, and so this gives you a sort of transition from one set of coordinates to another set of coordinates, and that's what's got to be differentiable. So the manifold is the whole, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. It's not just a set, it's a set with this associated underlying structure of looking locally like Rn. So a good example, the manifold is a sphere where you take, you could simply just cut it somewhere just either side of the equator. You then, for one chart, you would take the lower half of the sphere and you would map it onto the plane, put it over here. So this would take you from your sphere onto R squared, this is S2, right? And so this gives you one particular choice of coordinates, or you could go from the south pole out and get a different choice of coordinates. So what you would then say is, suppose I cut this off here at about let's say the Tropic of, which one's north, Capricorn or Cancer?
Cancer south.
Cancer south, right. So let's, we'll take this one. That's terrible, isn't it? Talking about,
I think it's the other way around.
It's the other way around, is it? Oh, all right. So this would be an example of two coordinate charts. We've got the lower half of the globe and the upper half of the globe, and then your coordinate, the intersection, is the tropics, and simply your requirement is that the relation between these coordinates here and these coordinates here is infinite, which is true for that particular map. Yeah?
And why is that we don't try to cover the whole sphere by just one chart?
Well, in this case you couldn't, because as you go up to this one, as you go up to the North Pole, right, as long as you're not on the North Pole, you can always get down onto the plane. The North Pole itself, strictly speaking, would map to infinity, so that's not really allowed within the rules of the game, right, for R squared. I mean, if you're doing complex numbers or Riemann surfaces, then obviously you would just complete the plane by adding a point at infinity. But in this case, we've got, you know, we actually want to have our sort of finite, we want to have our insects. So that's, I mean, that's just one example of a manifold. And so what we do, if we want to sort of build up more of a sort of algebra, more of a machinery on a manifold, we actually want to construct vectors. So we start off, you know, when we first meet vectors, we have this notion of something with a length and a direction, and that works very well. But the problem with our manifold is that it can be generally all quite knobbly. It can be curved. It doesn't have to be nice and flat. So if we're sitting on the two-sphere, if we wanted to draw an arrow, which is our normal conceptual way of thinking of a vector, we would kind of have to draw it within our manifold. And this is something which doesn't, it's neither straight, it's not clear whether we have a sort of good idea of a sense of length, although, you know, at least at this point, we have some concept of a sense of direction. So this doesn't seem to be a very satisfactory way of trying to define a vector. So we kind of have to sort of take a step back and think about what we mean by vectors. And so what we do is we, to define a vector, we take a curve. Everything's going to be infinitely differentiable, by the way. So what we do is we draw a line on our manifold, on our sphere, and a curve is simply a map. This is just a copy. We could say we're going along this line at a particular rate, so you could think of this as me walking through the room, for example, and this takes us just from some parameter t into the manifold itself. And we can think of this, and I'm going to put this in inverted commas because it's not strictly correct, as if we went to one of our charts as taking us through a path in our local coordinate system. And then to get our vector, we just take tangents to the curve. Now you need an orange or an apple or something. So what this is doing is, if we had our sphere, if we think about a curve going round on the sphere, if we take a tangent to that curve, what it's doing is it's like taking a little piece of paper, or locally one of these flat R squareds, and just putting it, laying it down on the edge of the sphere, making a tangent, because the vector's a tangent vector, tangent to the sphere at a particular point. So our vector lies on the sphere. Our vector at a particular point is lying in a copy of R squared, which is tangent to the sphere at that particular point. So we are still using our vector So our old concept of a vector as a point, you know, an arrow, a length and a direction, but the vector lives in a flat copy of R squared, which is tangent to our manifold. And so this is really why when you do general relativity, you have to go through this whole, or jump through all these hoops when you construct your, you know, your derivatives, the connection, because a vector can't actually live in the manifold itself. It has to live in one of these flat tangent planes to the manifold. And so you take your manifold, and at each point, it has one copy of this flat tangent plane. And so you've sort of made it a lot more of a complicated construction. And this is your tangent space, and then you've got a whole collection of tangent spaces at every point. So that's sort of a picture that you carry along with you about what vectors are. Yep.
So why do you have a collection of tangent spaces?
Because the way you define your vector, so here you've got this curve, right? You've got a map from the reals into the manifold. And then what you do is you say that my tangent vector, you can write it as this, and it's really saying that for every one of these functions here, f, you form t of f is equal to df by dt. So what you're actually doing is you're saying that this curve takes you from the reals, your parameter t, into the manifold. I go to a local set of coordinates to get me into this local copy of Rn. I then can take my function, I can then find an f of t, because I simply say it's f of x mu of t, where this is defined by my curve. And then once I've got f of t, I can take df dt. And that is what the tangent vector to the curve actually is. But this is true for all possible functions on the manifold. So the fact is, this is true for all of these functions on the manifold. So that is what makes it the tangent space. You're taking the derivative along the curve at a particular point on the curve. So there is no guarantee, you know, if you take the derivative here on this curve, and here, you know, these are two different points. The vectors are actually going to be potentially in different spaces, and this is the line of different spaces.
But at a single point, there's only one term?
So, at a single point, yes, I was being schematic. Maybe I have to fill this in a lot more. So at a single point, here's one curve gamma, and that gives me t. I could imagine a different curve, beta, and that might give me a different tangent vector, s. So if I just stick to two dimensions, because that's easier, in this case, I've got these two vectors. They're at the same point, p. I could imagine a third curve here, right, which, let's say, delta. And locally, I could make delta up by having a little bit of beta and a little bit of gamma. And so the tangent curve to delta, u, would be a sort of a little bit of s and a little bit of t. So the set of these tangent vectors at a point does actually form a vector space. And that's the vector space that, when you first meet vectors, is what you're used to. That was what I meant about the putting the little piece of paper on top of the sphere. So mathematicians just tend to write this object here as the vector, a sort of geometrical notation. When we do, usually with gravity or general relativity, we often write this to be a vector. So you've probably seen the notation that, yep.
Given Earth, there will be generally a plane which is tangent to it, in some sense.
So, well, for the curve, it's just a single vector. But at a point of the manifold, you've got a plane, and the curve is sort of coinciding with one particular direction within the plane.
So that fixes a unique direction within the
plane? Relative to the curve, yes. If you want to make a longer vector, you would go along the curve faster. So you would change your parameterization to make f dot bigger, for example. Mm-hmm. So that would correspond to, if you go along your curve faster, you have a longer vector. If you go along it slower, you have a shorter vector. But it would still be in the same direction. If you want a different direction, you take a different curve, which came through that point at a different angle, using our intuition or anything like that. So I just want to make a note of this, because I'm going to be in this initial part, I'm going to be using some of the geometrical notation. Although once I get on to talking about physics of either black holes or extra dimensions, I'll go back to more classical notation. But geometrical notation would be that T is the vector, and this would be the components of T. And these are just scalars. And this is with respect to a coordinate basis. In other words, when you have a vector space, you can choose a basis. This is where you choose your axes to align with your coordinates. But most often when you find it, most often we just actually write T mu to mean the vector. And this is something known as abstract index notation. I just want to comment on that, because when I do some of the machinery, I'm going to be using a bit of the geometrical notation, yes?
Sure. Just to make it clear for later, when you're using the geometric notation, the thing with the down index is the vector, like the differential operator.
Yes, so for example, this is this coordinate basis, but you could imagine taking another basis, right? This thing here is, as you say, this is the vector, right? So what you would do if you wanted to change basis, you would write more generally. I'll try and remember to underline things when I'm using the geometric notation. You would write it as something like this. So these T would again be the components in the new basis. And again, these are scalars. And this would be some arbitrary basis. So a common example of a basis that you tend to meet is is an orthonormal basis. And an orthonormal basis is just one in which your distance is just plus or minus one. So in other words, your G, the components of your metric, which would be sort of these, take your coordinate expression, contract it with your orthonormal basis, and you should just get the straight plus one Minkowski metric, which would be the metric with ones along the diagonal. So your orthonormal basis you think of as being your sort of standard triad that you might, for example, have if you're in a spherically symmetric system, you might have sort of spherical polar coordinates, and then you would have an orthonormal basis corresponding to a unit radial vector, a unit sort of theta vector, and a unit azimuthal vector. So that would be an example of an orthonormal basis. So you can have more complicated examples of bases, particularly when you get to some more complicated space-times. But as a rule, when we take bases, either we're dealing with coordinate bases, in which case the actual basis vectors are very neat. They're sort of simple, and everything is, all your geometry, all your mess, all the physics is contained in the G. Or you choose a basis such that your metric looks nice and simple, and all the mess is contained in this orthonormal basis. So these E's are sometimes known as the Feivein or tetrad. And the usefulness of the coordinate basis is it's perhaps slightly more reliable if you're doing calculations for the gravity, for the space-time side. But if you wanted to, for example, to look at spinners on space-time, if you wanted to do the Dirac equation on a space-time, what you would want an orthonormal basis, because you know that when you define Dirac matrices, you define them so that your anticommutator gives you the Lorentz metric, plus one, minus one. So if you can get your space-time curved metric to look like this plus and minus one metric, you do your gamma matrices with respect to the orthonormal basis, and you throw all of the geometry, all of the mess that gravity gives you into the Feivein. So it just depends what you want to do as to which is useful. Questions actually. Go on, you haven't had one.
But this, of course, would just be local, wouldn't it? You can only transform into the orthonormal basis.
That's right, yeah. Usually it's a local basis, it's in a particular coordinate chart. One subtlety just for those if you want to put a spinners on space-time, if you want to put a spin structure, you actually need to be able to have something which is effectively a global orthonormal basis. So, well, yeah, in the sense that, yes, you generally can. It's just sort of a question of, you're allowed to use sort of local coordinates, but the idea is you should be able to pin, to choose everywhere one of these. It's like combing, if you imagine sort of combing something anyway. So that's just the only sort of little proviso, once you curve your space. So I know I'm going through this quite quickly. My aim is to sort of give you enough pointers, fill in enough of the details so that when you go to, if you want to go to, what the book on the more formal side of generativity, I mean, for example, Bob Wall's book, or I think Sean Carroll also, his notes or his book go into the details of this. This is sort of trying to give you like signposts, the sort of key points, the key features of the mathematics behind general relativity. I know my pure maths friends would be horrified if they just put it that way. So that's vectors, you know, how one defines a vector in general, and also a bit about bases. But we also need covectors, so these would be covariant in the sort of old, the classical notation. And these are things with indices downstairs, as you would have met them, right? Vectors are things with indices upstairs. So covectors, these are defined in this geometrical way as maps from the vectors to the reals. So we have that our space of vectors, I didn't write it down, I don't think. Write our tangent space as TP of M, we write our cotangent space as TP star. And an element of this cotangent space notationally, this is essentially, think of it as a bit line, a sort of scalar product or a contraction. It takes a vector and gives a scalar. So in terms of our, if we thought of this in terms of our index notation, we would say that our vector v went to va omega a. So if that's the notation that you're used to, that's what it does. And then we've got a dual basis. So we imagine that we have, if we've got a basis for our vector space, we simply say the dual basis is what gives us the Kronecker delta. So with normal three-dimensional Cartesian space, these things, the vectors and their duals, are the same thing. It would be a unit vector in the x direction in each case. And then we simply build up tensors by taking products. At the moment, yes, absolutely. So ultimately, obviously, the metric takes you between this vector space and its dual. But I guess I'm not emphasizing it because in the context of gravity, we always have a metric. We always have a distance function. But everything I'm saying in this first revision type lecture is really quite independent of any metric. This is just how mathematicians would define vectors, would define these covectors. And at the moment, we have no way of getting between the two, not until we introduce a metric. So that's the sort of basic structure. We have this idea.
This way of thinking of it, do we ever need to think of it in this way when we're doing physics, like a map?
Okay, well, right, so what I'm going to be doing, my reason for doing this, in part, is I'm going to be using these particular orthonormal bases to derive some information about some algebraic structure of the space-time. I'm going to use them to define an algebraic way of getting curvatures, which on the one hand gives you a much quicker, more reliable way of calculating curvatures. It's also, if you want to go on and do supergravity, it's the type of formalism that you need in order to be able to do it. And when you're dealing with some more complicated space-time, so some of the particular manifolds that people use in some of these warped compactifications of string theory, a lot of those are very nicely expressed in terms of a basis which, if you wrote it down from the coordinate point of view, it's an absolute mess. It's a dog's breakfast. But if you use these nice field bounds, not four dimensions, but if you use these more general expressions, things can become simpler. It's like a sledgehammer to crack a nut, really, in some sense, if you're just doing some very simple four-dimensional physics. But it can pay off later on. And it depends how far you want to take gravity, but it is very useful. I've found it an indispensable tool. So I've said that this early bit is trying to build up a toolkit. So it seems like you're kind of taking a step back and you're doing an awful lot of formal stuff, but it does sometimes come back and pay you back. So I agree, it does seem a little strange. Right, so that's just in a very, very short time trying to describe what covectors and vectors are. So far, all I've done is I've put these tangent planes, these little cards, at different points on the two sphere, but I've said nothing about, it all seems very disjoint and not very helpful yet, right?
Mm-hmm. So we all know vectors are sort of physically. Yeah. What's a covector?
Right, so a covector, well, a way of visualizing it, which I can't, I've got to get to another bit before I really visualize it that way. But one way of visualizing a covector is if you think of the vector as being sort of something, it's this arrow with a sense of direction and a length, your covector would be like the complement of that arrow. It would be something which had, if you're in three dimensions, it would be a plane which was normal to the arrow. So the covector, and this is a little bit easier to see when I've talked a bit more about differentiation, a covector you can think of as being a sort of set of planes. So if you had a function, you've got your function on the manifold. If you thought of this as being a surface of f equals constant, your covector would in some sense be the normal to that surface. If you had a metric, it would literally be the normal to that surface. So that would be your covector. So you can think of covectors as sort of associated with n minus one dimensional sort of sets of surfaces.
So, but you cannot assign a direction of the normal.
I'm sorry, obviously.
Oh, sorry. So these are hypersurfaces?
Yes. Yeah. So it's, I mean, that is, if you want to picture it geometrically without, you know, I mean, I'm drawing a normal there, but by doing that, I am sort of mentally thinking a little bit of having a bit more structure there, but you can think of it as being that sort of thing. Yes?
If you don't mind, I'd like to mention my favorite example of this. A magnetic field, you know, is like a vector field, but it's a vector every point in space. And you can get these like magnetic fields measuring devices, and it's got like a little square of metal at the tip, and that metal you can think of it as a piece of the surface, and when you hold the square out, it measures how much magnetic field is piercing that part of the surface. So that it's like the measuring device is the covector, and the magnetic field is the vector.
Yeah, so it's got this same concept there of the planes. So now what I want to do is to, I won't, just want to, we'll, I'll discuss it and then we'll take a break actually, so I don't want to do anything formally. But the next thing we'd like to do is to start thinking about how we might link these tangent planes together. So what you've actually done when you did general relativity, you talked about having a covariant derivative. So you looked at vectors, you then wanted to take derivatives of vectors, and you figured out that if you try to just take a straightforward derivative d by dx of a vector, that didn't give you a tensor. Because if you did a coordinate transformation, you got some extra piece left over. It didn't transform covariantly. And the way you got around that was by introducing the Christoffel symbols. So, I mean, or some variant of that was probably how you came across them. And what the Christoffel symbols do in the case of gravity is they link together these different tangent planes. Because when you take a derivative, what you're doing is you're usually taking, so q prime is a limit of you take an object at the point you want the derivative, you go a little bit further on, you subtract, you divide by the amount and sort of distance you've gone, and that's your derivative. So this is what you do in general. The problem with taking derivatives of vectors is moving a little bit away in the manifold means moving away from this point P here. And as you move away, you've gone from the tangent plane of P to some different tangent plane. And so your two vectors live in different vector spaces. And you're not allowed to compare two things from a different space. So you've got to find a way of comparing Q at some, this would be at a point P, and this would be at some point P plus H. You've got to find a way of comparing vectors at different points. So the way that you're familiar with from general relativity is that you use the Levi-Civita connection, with these Christoffel symbols, and they give you a way of tying together the tangent planes. And obviously I'm going to go over that again. But there are other alternatives. There are different ways you can take derivatives without having a metric. And so what I wanted to do, what I'll pick up with once we've had a little break, is I want to talk about something called the Lie derivative, which allows you to take this quantity, compare this vector at P plus H with a vector at P by using some curves to sort of drag yourself along from one point to the next. So I also want to talk about another way of taking a derivative, which is called exterior differentiation. and that's something which works on anti-symmetric cotensors. So I'm sure you did covariant derivative. I don't think you did Lie derivative, and I'm not sure if you did exterior derivative. So both of these are other ways of taking derivatives on manifolds. So that's what I'll do after a break.